I want to thank you for taking the time to come and speak with me and for sending me a copy of your fantastic book, Pioneers of Oneness. It was a real pleasure to read through it. I read through most of it when I was traveling through Egypt and taking some notes, and I found myself resonating with much of what you had to say, which is why I'm so excited to jump into this with you today. So thank you for taking the time to be here.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's always a pleasure to talk to people about my work.
If you would like to start by just giving us a little bit of a brief introduction of who you are and what started this interest in tackling the big questions in life, like consciousness and UFOs.
Yes, well, it started early on, I imagine. I have a vague memory of reading George Adamski's first book about contact with visitors from space as a teenager sometime, even though I didn't do much with it then. When I was traveling along the hippie trail in the late 1970s, I picked up some books by Eric von Däniken.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I really enjoy those. You know, I found them fascinating, especially where he zooms in on the anomalies in paleontology and archaeology and other things. And I still didn't really do much with it or link it to anything else until I had an experience when I was in India, and it sounds perhaps a bit, the default hippie trail traveler finds enlightenment, but it wasn't like that at all. It was just a very profound experience of the oneness of life that during the night, it wasn't a vision, it wasn't a dream. I don't know what it was, but I woke up with it and it stayed with me for several weeks, and it left me with a feeling of bliss, I suppose you could say. And I didn't know what to do with it until I read a book that introduced me to, this was on the way back, traveling back from India and Nepal to Europe. I read a book that introduced me to what is now not what I know now to be the Ageless Wisdom teachings. These were reintroduced to the modern world through the work of Madame Blavatsky in the late 19th century. A little bit later, in 1978, I read the first interview with the Scottish artist and futurologist, Benjamin Creme. And he's best known for his mission of informing the world about the imminent return of what he calls the world teacher, who he said is expected really in every religion. And that's when things started to fall into place for me, all the different pieces. And I've been involved with a network of volunteers around the world to help him disseminate this information until I... as a student of the teachings of the Ageless Wisdom, I delved deeper into what is known as the accounts of the contactees of the 1950s, George Adamski being the most well-known. There's been many others, Truman Bethrum, Howard Menger, Buck Nelson. Those are just a few of the Americans, but there have been people in other parts of the world as well, although not quite as well-known. And that's when I saw the correspondences in the, shall we say, the worldview, the outlook on life between the teachings of the Ageless Wisdom and the accounts of the contactees, the accounts of their experiences with visitors from space and how they see life. For me, that is the main thing about, lots of people think of UFOs as fascinating because of the technology and the mystery that surrounds them, because we don't have the technology and what could we do if we had it, and why is the government are governments covering it up, etc., what they know. But to me, the real story of the visitors from space and what they taught their contacts here on Earth is actually quite the same, identical with the teachings of the Ancient Wisdom. And that is that underneath the objective reality that we know lies consciousness. It's the evolution of consciousness that drives our, our civilizations, the emergence and the growth and blossoming and the decline of our civilizations. It drives our progress on the path of evolution, and therefore also our invention of new technologies. So when, for instance, Benjamin Graham talks about the imminent emergence of the world teacher as the individual on this planet who has traveled the farthest on the path of evolution in terms of consciousness, he's really talking, and the teachings are really talking about the evolution of consciousness as a prospect for the human race, for human beings. And the same can actually be said about the teachings that came through, the information that came through the contactees in the 1950s. Mind you, soon enough, the 1950s contactees were ridiculed and dismissed because of their, new UFO religion, and they had no physical proof of anything, no evidence, etc. But the what I now find very interesting, and which I've tried to also tackle in my book, is that this notion of consciousness underlying everything that we know and see and can touch and experience, it's not about creating a mystery for planet Earth or human beings. It's about showing that life is one, and despite all the different things that we see around us, or whether it's dense physical or liquid physical or gaseous physical, whether it's wood or metal or water, it really all stems from the same source. Even though that's it's hard to imagine, but science, the latest insights in of science shows that there is one source that it all stems from, and that consciousness underlies that source and the emergence of everything we know. So when I saw that the teachings of the Ages of Wisdom and the accounts of the contactees, and now quantum research, post-materialist science, the quantum research, they all point to the same thing. And I think that's fascinating.
Well, this is something I wanted to kind of focus on at the start, because and it's something you address early in your book, and it's a recurring theme throughout. And I've talked about this myself, that I truly feel that science is playing catch up to the intuitive intelligence of thousands of years of spiritual teachings and the type of things that have been suggested for so long, way before the dawn of science, which are now starting to come to fruition through this observational lens of science and technology that we've adopted. So the fact that modern day science, especially within the realms of physics and more specifically in emerging models and theories in quantum mechanics, are leading us closer towards an understanding of reality that incorporates consciousness into the fundamental building blocks of life, rather than simply being considered as an emergent property in the human brain and being seen more as a field phenomenon, or what a physicist would refer to as information. And I think that we're getting closer to almost a type of animism model that explains from a scientific perspective the conscious nature of the universe. And so how do you approach this question? What do you feel makes the most sense when attempting to explain explain or understand the potential origins of consciousness?
I think I'm not entirely current, you know, with all the ideas in consciousness studies. But I think, from what I know, idealism or pan-idealism comes very close. What we need to realize, and that's what I meant when I said that when the teachings speak about the evolution of consciousness, it means that, or I see it as consciousness being a fundamental quality of the creative principle. And, you know, there's so many names for that creative principle, and they all obfuscate, and they all, you know, they all limit the creative principle, because that's really the all in all, the endless, eternal, infinite, that we cannot say anything useful about. You can call it God, or the absolute, or the infinite father, or what have you. But the creative principle manifests life, and life is universal through the evolution of consciousness. So consciousness, you have it at a very fundamental level, and from there, you know, the fundamental building blocks of the world around us are now seen as quanta, little bundles of energy in the ocean of energy. We live in an energetic universe, but the quanta are without qualities, without the qualia. The qualia emerge, I think, through consciousness, or perhaps consciousness and qualia can be equated. I'm not sure. You know, it's consciousness that imbues, that informs, inspires the energetic bundles that make up the quanta, which make up our atoms and our molecules and our organisms, etc. And there seem to be according to the teachings, there are seven different types of qualities or characteristics that express through consciousness, and they are called the seven rays of energy. I don't know if you need to go into that right now, but that's from billions and billions different combinations of those seven energies. Everything that we know has come into being, and it's that. But you know, the important thing to remember is that it is life, which is universal, manifesting through the evolution of consciousness. And it's not that, you know, nowadays lots of people think, well, you know, if we have better technology soon enough, you know, we can evolve into a better place, or into a better state of mind, or into a more responsible attitude towards the world around us. But, you know, in consciousness, we've already evolved to the point where we know that we are one, even though, and by we, I mean not only the human kingdom, but we, the human kingdom, with planet Earth and all the other kingdoms in nature. It's just that through the structures in which we live, and which we find so difficult to leave behind, as they are no longer fit for purpose, they make us do things that are really destroying our world and our lives. They're destroying our minds, as we see around us in healthcare systems around the world, you know, with enormous numbers of people suffering from depression and numbers in suicide rising, etc. People don't know where to look anymore. And I think that's due to the fact that we have evolved, even if we're not aware of it in consciousness, in awareness of the fact that we are one, but we're not able to manifest it yet, to express it yet in our daily lives.
Yeah, the symptoms are becoming very clear within society that there are problems and that there are ways in which we should be evolving that perhaps we're not and we're being held back. And I think that for a long time within our own developmental story as human beings, we were a primarily shamanistic species that was in symbiosis with its environment. And as we moved into the agricultural age and further still into the Industrial Revolution and the so-called Age of Enlightenment, we severed this spiritual shamanistic connection in favor of a scientific and technologically orientated process. And it feels to me that we're now approaching a time, which we've just kind of highlighted, where these two aspects might be coming together, the logical and the intuitional, or the scientific and the shamanistic, that perhaps we're coming to a point now where science and spirit will move closer together. Do you feel that science and technology, despite their ability to create destructive processes, could also play a spiritual, or at the very least a more ethical role if used in the right way as we move forward?
Well, you know, I'm not anti-technology or science, far from it. It's just that the focus that we've developed as a race, a human race, over the past 2,000 years, but especially since the Age of Enlightenment, as you call it, and as it's called, the focus on the material aspect of life and our existence is what's undoing us at the moment.
Yeah.
The shamanistic sense of life, way of life, I think that was, that stems from a period in the evolution of humanity on this planet, which was a rather dark period, because there have, according to the teachings, the wisdom teachings, there have been great civilizations, and not just one or two, but many great civilizations before our Western civilization. Civilizations are, it's like the cycles in nature. They emerge they blossom and they decline. And we've seen some examples of that in smaller and shorter cycles in our recent history, like the Roman Empire, etc. The evolution that we've gone through in the past 2,000 years has brought us the analytical method that we also need, that we need to manipulate the physical world around us. And it has brought us great advantages and progress in terms of technology that has made life easier for
millions. It's allowed us to communicate. We're talking right now,
Exactly, yes. And in the 1960s, this was only impossible in Star Trek, but now we use it in real life. It's an absolutely necessary part of our evolution to have this analytical mind at our possession. But it's only the first step of developing our mental faculties and abilities. According to the teachings, if I just give a broad outline. According to the teachings, the history of humanity on this planet goes back 18.5 million years. That's when the first race species emerged that could remotely be called human in appearance and purpose. But for it to evolve to the point where we are now, it first had to perfect the physical body, and that took millions of years. After that, it took many. This was the what is known as the Lemurian period. After that, during the times of Atlantis, another millions of years, the human race developed its emotional apparatus, its sensory apparatus, which is now the body of expression that we live in and that we relate to most easily, and that really that we feel most comfortable with. It's we've also almost developed it to a point of perfection. Now, you know, since, I don't know, 10,000, 100,000 years, I think we've, human race has started to develop its mental body, its mental vehicle. And this is an early stage where, you know, we're developing the concrete mind, the lower mind. And as I said, that's necessary, but our spiritual nature, we can only contact on the planes of the higher mind. You know, that's where the connection between the spiritual man or woman and the physical man or woman can be found. And that is the juncture where we are in our evolution as a human race now. Not everyone individually, but as a race on this planet. And of course, that makes it so crucial and momentous this time in history, because, as I said, you know, we live in an energetic universe. Up until recently, it was possible for science to say, well, you know, astrology is nonsense. So when people say, well, you know, we're now in the age of Aquarius, so whole different energies are streaming in, scientists would say, well, that's rubbish, that's hullabaloo, that's nonsense. But when you know that we live in an energetic universe, and we, as a solar system and as a planet, we have these massive cosmic energies impinging on our system from different sources, which change over time, cycle after cycle, then it's not so crazy to assume that the energies that manifest through our evolution and through our human expression, our human lives, changes as well. And the according to the teachings in the past 2,000 years, the Christian era, we have developed the notions of idealism and individuality. And we can see that, you know, almost to a crystallized extent in our current the way we relate to each other. You know, it's almost everyone head on against everyone. In extremism, in fundamentalism, in intolerance. Everybody has their own belief, and there's no other way but my way. And again, you know, like science, the scientific materialist scientific view of reality as something that you can pick apart and put back together in any way that you fancy. That's what this is destroying us. That's what's so dangerous about this time. And we need to realize that our understanding of life is outdated. The conventional scientific understanding of life is outdated. We have invented the internet. You just pointed out, rightfully so, the fact that our technology allows us that you and I speak face to face across a distance of how many miles? I don't know. You in the UK, me in Amsterdam, in Holland. The internet allows us to be aware of things that happen almost instantly on the other side of the world. Transportation, communication technologies have made the world, reduced the world to a global village, and smaller even. And yet our structures, political, financial, economic, social in many ways, they are still based on the old outdated notions of we are all separate individuals, and we have to, you know, we have to compete for a living. And those are the two notions that cannot be reconciled. We need to understand that our understanding of life is really about our, or understanding life is about our understanding of life, which is limited. And we need to expand our view. We need to expand our understanding of life to include that spiritual aspect that you referred to, and to realize that we're all engaged on that path of evolution in terms of consciousness.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, you know, modern science wants to try and decode and understand reality, but at the same time, it actually dismisses some of the strongest anchors that each of us have individually, because each of us as individuals having a human experience, I think we would all say that the strongest anchors into reality are our, how we feel emotionally, how we feel intuitively, the connections we have in life, the things that we share with each other. All of this is what builds up and creates a human life experience, and all of that is thrown away and put to the side as, and seen as unnecessary by the scientific method. And it's funny to me because there are so many instances throughout this, our scientific history, of intuition informing the facts that are then discovered later down the line. I mean, Einstein, Nikola Tesla, René Descartes, all of these people who are the kind of principal founders of so many of our rational scientific doctrines were actually getting intuitive information. They said so themselves, and this is always dismissed and it's always rationalized away after the fact. And I think that we are having to now get to that point where we are acknowledging that a lot of these intuitive insights are a part of reality, and that science is just a little bit slow to the party.
Absolutely, absolutely. But many people are slow to the party as well, you know. And you can't, you know, I wonder if you can even blame them, because when Madame Blavatsky was alive and disseminating her teachings, she introduced to the world the notion of members of the human kingdom who have evolved beyond the strictly human state, who have mastered their lower nature and the laws of nature and laws of physics, etc. So they can do things that seem miraculous to us, just because we don't have that understanding of the laws of nature or control over them. They're known in the teachings as the masters of wisdom, and they are a body of formerly men and women who have evolved to that point. She was, Madame Blavatsky was not a master of wisdom herself. She didn't claim that status for herself, but she did show lots of miraculous feats, miraculously looking feats, and she credited her teachers, masters of wisdom, for the philosophy and the knowledge and the information in her books. But when, you know, the Society for Psychical Research, I believe it's a conglomerate of skeptics and people who are interested in psychic phenomena, when they instigated they wanted to find out if she was a fraud or not. Mm-hmm. Well, they were looking into an inquiry, yes. They were looking into accusations that she was a fraud, and the person who did the inquiry and wrote the report was rather biased himself. So the conclusion was she is a fraud, and she's still suffering from that label. But in this report came out in 1885. But the same Society for Psychical Research unequivocally retracted that report a century later in 1986. You know, can you blame people for saying, oh, yeah, Blavatsky, you know, the same with George Adamski. George Adamski and the other contactees from the 1950s. Yeah. Yeah. Has been made out to be a fraud and a liar and what have you. If you actually look into his claims, his photographs and the information that he's given, a lot of it is now being corroborated by, if you talked about science.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, but fortunately, there's a whole emerging new branch of science, I would say, post-materialist science, informed by quantum research and consciousness research, etc. And when you look at Adamski's work and teachings from that angle, a lot of it is being confirmed now or corroborated. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is usually the way, isn't it? You're called a heretic or a crazy person while you're alive, and then years later you're heralded as a thought leader.
Well, yeah, but even today, you know, it's now 70 years this year, 70 years since George Adamski's first person-to-person contact in the desert with a visitor from space. You know, for instance, I've done a lot of research. And I've written about him. And my work is usually, it's not touched upon by other. It's not taken seriously by either UFO researchers, because it's not about the nuts and the bolts and the screws and the buttons, or a piece of metal, or propulsion technology, because, as Adamski said, and I think, as you and I know, it's not about that. You know, that will follow once we've made that shift in outlook on life, and once we've shown that it's safe for us to have that technology. If it would be in our hands right now, we would blow up the world.
Yeah.
You know, first blow up other countries, and then finally the planet. And we're doing a very good job of doing so without that advanced technology. It's really about our outlook of life on life, and we need to realize it's essential that we begin to see not only one another, you know, other human beings, the whole human race, as one organism on this planet, one species, but we are one with the planet as well. And it doesn't mean we all have to be friends. You know, that's not possible. There's always going to be different characters and different personalities and different talents and different conditioning and different ideas about the world and how we should go forward. But we can still do so in a way that where we can all contribute our talents to the common good. You know, and that's the only safe way forward from this very dangerous juncture in human history.
Yeah, I think the nuts and bolts aspect, obviously it's the easiest part to wrap your head around, but I still feel that the actual technological sophistication of these UFOs is just evidence of a sophistication in consciousness, that it's a manifestation of their sophisticated level of consciousness, and we're not going to get that without the evolution of the mind, without the evolution of spirit. And in some ways, it's almost, I think one of my favorite lecturers to listen to, Terence McKenna, said something similar when he was saying that the UFO is almost like a shadow of the potential of humanity hovering above us, kind of haunting our skies and bringing us closer towards it. But you need to evolve in the mind before you can start getting the toys.
Nice one. Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed. It's not that we haven't, like I said, I think we've made the step in consciousness already. It's just that we're not aware of it yet.
Yeah.
And we're stuck in these old ways and the old structures. And the interesting thing now is this is, I think, the most interesting time to be alive, because we can see the structures literally crumbling under our feet and, you know, coming down around us. Which is scary, can be very scary, because our energy sources are depleting, our natural resources are depleting very fast. The climate is breaking down around us. Financial systems are only running because they're being propped up. But, you know, the social structures are of such mind-blowing injustice when you see that. I just had a new shower installed a month ago, and the shower head that came with it, it passes 12 liters of water per minute. And And of course, there's also water saving shower heads that you can install. So I went out to get one, which saves half of that amount per minute. And I thought that was necessary because, you know, there's millions of people who do not even have 1 liter of clean water a day for cooking and washing and drinking. The problem of migration, you know, it's not because people from other parts of the world necessarily want to live in our part of the world. It's just that they lack any kind of prospect for themselves and for their children. And that's not an accident of nature or an act of God. It's because of faulty economic, very skewed economic structures and treaties that have been imposed after the colonial period. And, you know, it's multinational corporations dictating on the international markets what they will pay for natural resources and what they will charge for finished products. And people are left without livelihoods, etc. So, you know, all these things, all the structures that we live in, they have served their purpose for many years for millions of people, but they are now actually our biggest threat.
Yeah. Well, this is, I mean, for me, this is something that I honestly try and associate with my own personal life, because I think everyone listening, and yourself included, has gone through these types of situations on a personal level where the foundations of your reality are collapsing, whether it be a relationship breaking down or whatever it might be, you're you know, losing your job. And at the time, it's always chaos, it's always dark, it's always pain. And then upon reflection, you look back and realize, oh, actually, this led to here, led to here, led to here. And so when I look at the world and I look at the fact that, as you rightly said, the structures are just collapsing and it's so transparent now that it's unfit for purpose and it's crumbling away. That, for me, is the best evidence of a light on the horizon that we are moving towards something better. But we've got to get through some shit first.
Oh, you bet, yes. And you know, we're going through it right now. Mm-hmm. You know, we see the cost of living crisis, we see the energy crisis and the climate crisis. And it's not, you know, it's not holding up. It's it will get worse before it gets better. But the I think it's also important to point out that the UFOs have come here in greater number. I mean, they've always been here. There are Old Testament accounts that can easily be identified appearances of UFOs, instances of UFO sightings, etc., experiences. So they've always been here, but they are here now at this time in human history, in modern history, since especially the 1950s, in support, I believe, of this major step in evolution that we are about to take, that we have to take, and that we have to manifest. We have to give expression to that step in consciousness. And just as you know, the UFOs are here in support, according to the wisdom teachings, and most recently according to Benjamin Krebs, the superhuman, if you will, individuals who have stayed behind on our planet to oversee human evolution and inspire us with their wisdom. They are also returning to the everyday world. It is for that reason that Madame Blavatsky was asked in the late 19th century to make the first inroads into modern society with the philosophy that she branded theosophy. More generally, I prefer the term the Age's Wisdom, and you know, because it introduces the whole concept of the evolution of consciousness. She was really the first to I don't know if she coined the term, but she was the first to describe that. You know, her major mm-hmm. opus, The Secret Doctrine. Mm-hmm. Is really the two volumes, the the origin of the cosmos and the origin of humanity. My words, my memory fails sometimes. The teachings that she presented to the world were new, and you know, and they broke up and this whole mold of thinking. And she was, of course, she was labeled a fraud. But her teachings were elaborated on early in the 20th century by Alexander Bailey, who also worked with the Master of Wisdom. And since 1975, Benjamin Graham took on his mission to actually openly state that these masters of wisdom and the world teacher as at their head are returning to the world at this time in history as part of their own evolution, but especially in order to assist and inspire humanity to make this huge transition, because it is a dangerous time. You know, we have these means of destroying ourselves and the planet. They're still, despite all the treaties from the 1980s and 90s, there's still, I don't know how many nuclear bombs and other destructive weaponry. We have to be guided, if you will. But it's done very gently, you know, it's not done by force. It's not like somebody steps down and tells us this is what you have to do now or else, because we have free will, you know, as a human race. But it's important to remember that we are not alone.
Yeah. You
know,
yeah.
We are guided and inspired by people who were struggling like us in everyday life with, you know, understanding world, understanding life, and who have overcome all the limitations of being a spirit in the flesh, in incarnation, and who have reconnected with the source, the spirit. We call it the soul, but that's also just a limited view of the real spirit that underlies who we really are. And when individuals from the human kingdom evolve to that state of masterhood become a master of wisdom, most of them, they move on to a higher planet, higher system, higher path of evolution. But there's always a certain number that remain on this planet to guide and inspire us. And at this time, and it's been a movement that has been in preparation for centuries. They are returning to the world, and the world teacher, as Benjamin Graham said, is expected. And I pointed out in my book as well, is expected in every religion. You know, the Christians are waiting for the second coming, and the Buddhists are waiting for Maitreya, the fifth Buddha, and the Hindus are waiting for the 10th incarnation of Vishnu or Kalki avatar, in the sections of Islam where they expect the 12th Mahdi who disappeared. So it's a very universal religious notion. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing, I think, is when you bring down the main religions to their essence, it comes down to really three points. Mm. All major religions expect the coming or the return of a new teacher who will come to teach us about the source of consciousness, a personal God, Allah, what have you, and the way to return or to reconnect with that source. The word religion, the origin of religare, means to reconnect. So they will teach us, their teachings are meant not to divide us, but to reconnect with our spiritual source. And all of them, as we can see in the golden rule, all of them say that their teachings need to be manifested, need to be expressed according to the golden rule. Yeah. Treat your neighbor like you want to be treated yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's about establishing right human relations. And of course, that is what is so so blatantly lacking in our world today, both in, you know, domestically and internationally, especially internationally. And unless we let go of our structures that divide us and that make us compete for a living, for a place under the sun, and realize that we are one human kingdom, one human race. We only have one planet at the moment to live on. And other planets are inhabited by their own people. They don't need us to colonize there. And, you know, establish right human relations among ourselves. That is the only safe way forward for humanity on this planet. And again, fortunately, we are lucky to have the guidance and the help from the people who have made that reconnection with their source from both our own planet and other planets who come here in their UFOs to help us do that.
I guess for a lot of people it's a sense of powerlessness, because power and influence is so condensed in our world into a very small pocket of people that hold most of the cards. And so for me, you know, it's like, well, when you're looking at such a monstrous structure, it's almost impossible to think that you could take it down on your own. But I have this feeling that, in all honesty, it's just running itself into the ground anyway. Like, there's no escape from the degradation of these old systems. It's going to happen. Whether or not you have to have some form of direct impact on that, I think at the end of the day, as each individual human being, the only thing we can really do is focus on self-development and the love of our families and our friends and our kind of local sphere of influence, and to, you know, kind of do what you can to spread a more positive message. But in terms of actually tackling that structure that's holding us back, I think it's just going to collapse under its own weight.
Well, it very much looks like that at the moment. But at the same time, it's interesting to see how, you know, what can be achieved when people unite.
Yeah.
You know, just think of, and you know, in the short time that has passed, it may look as if they've been ineffective, but Occupy Wall Street, for instance. You know, that was such a hope-inspiring movement of people trying to connect at a very local, very personal, individual level. That really opened up a lot of, to a lot of people, that opened up a whole new view of life and values. Just now, as we speak, you know, the existing governing structure in Sri Lanka is under assault from the populace. There have been many examples of that. In 1986, I believe it was the Philippines. But in the 1980s, the late 1980s, early 1990s, you know, the behemoth that was the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. You know, I don't know how old you are, but for me, it's still very vivid, you know, in my mind's eye. I can still see the images of night after night. There was one country after another in the Eastern Bloc where people were fed up of having no freedom of movement and you know, not enough food, not enough choice of what to do with their lives. And they had enough, and they just overran the border patrols who were armed, you know, and these were overrun, as I said, and there was nothing they could do. So when people unite, you know, there's so much that's possible. It's just what I find baffling now is that so many people seem to be numbed.
Apathetic.
People seem so preoccupied with, or maybe they've done it on purpose because it seems so overwhelming, the problems that we experience in the world. But people seem so numb and unwilling to bring others together and fight for the same.
Well, I think the media has certainly played a role in that, because, you know, we are constantly inundated with global issues and you know, terrible things happening all over the world. So I think for a lot of people, they have been desensitized to this idea that we should be pushing against this instead of just sitting there on the sofa and watching it on TV. I think that a lot of people have lost that sense of we must do something, we have to change, what are we doing? We're so used to seeing these struggles that it's just become part of normal life.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. But, you know, it will require our active involvement to change anything. Because, you know, I mentioned the Masters of Wisdom. I mentioned the visitors from space, the Space Brothers, as they're sometimes called, Space Brothers and Sisters. They're not going to do it for us.
No.
You know, the world teacher or the Christ or whoever is not going to do it for us unless we take the steps that are necessary. We will just run our society, our civilization into the ground, and we will just be there in ruins. We have to pick ourselves up, and the longer we wait, the harder it will be. So yeah, let's do something.
Well, the forces are building up. That's what we were saying. Things are starting to crumble and collapse. And, you know, the cost of living is rising and rising. I mean, just the other week in London, there were thousands of people on the streets protesting about the cost of living. So it feels to me that people, it may be uncomfortable and turbulent, but I think people are going to be pushed towards making actions happen because they're literally seeing their lives start to fall apart. And so I think one issue is probably the level of comfort that some people exist at. Obviously, in comparison to a large portion of the global population, I'm living a very good life just because I have a roof over my head, I have running water, I have gas and electricity, I've got food in the fridge. These things keep me comfortable, and maybe there is a level of discomfort that we need to kind of wake up and go, oh, right, yeah, this isn't going to last forever. We need to do something now. And I think we're getting closer to that point. And I think that for a lot of people, as we were saying before, it's intimidating. It feels like everything's falling apart. But just like in your life, when you need to make changes and you're not making those changes, forces start to build up, pressures start to build up, and if you don't address it, then it's going to be a bad time. So I think this is the time, as you said, a very important time to be alive and a very important time to address these fundamental errors that we're making as humanity.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I've actually thought, you know, over the past 20, 25 years that we had gotten to that point. Mm-hmm. For instance, during the 2008 financial crisis, but that apparently
didn't do the trick.
Didn't affect too many people, not enough people in any case. And we may well see the perfect storm gathering here, where on a variety of levels, cost of living, you know, pandemic, energy crisis, the effects of climate crisis, it will bring enough people together to stand up and be counted and be heard and start changing things.
So bringing this to UFOs for a minute, there have been many interpretations over the years with strange lights and anomalies in the sky being reported back far into antiquity, as we were saying before. But due to the incredible level of stigma associated with the subject from, again, as we were saying, about the 1950s onwards, there was a very strong attempt to discredit and make this not a sensible discussion to have. It's given most people the impression that the UFO phenomenon is nothing more than, I guess, a phenomenon of the less educated, nothing but a series of misidentifications with ultimately prosaic explanations behind them. And I think a lot of these skeptical individuals are really having to reconsider their position due to the recent changes within the US government that have led towards official acknowledgement by the Pentagon that there is some form of technology being utilized by what they claim is an unknown actor exhibiting performance capabilities that outmatch our most advanced military assets and breaking the laws of physics as we understand them. What are your thoughts on this new revival of interest in UFOs since around 2017 when the New York Times published its front page article on the ATIP program? What are your thoughts on everything that's unfolded over the past few years regarding the US government and UFOs?
Yeah, well, to begin with, it's long overdue, of course.
Yeah, of course.
This acknowledgement that there's something going on that cannot be explained, and that have been recorded and been witnessed by by military personnel long overdue. What doesn't surprise me, though, that when you read the, you know, there have been hearings and there's been a preliminary report published, and there the narrative that was seeded, I think, also in the 1950s through popular, you know, things like mainly movies, the threat of alien invasions and death rays from Mars, etc. The preliminary report that has come out as a result of the developments that you just described talks about the threat.
Mm-hmm.
Not a potential threat, and but a threat, and you know, we have to establish what kind of threat it is and how to deal with it, which is of course completely against every available piece of evidence in terms of sightings and things. No, not one instance of aggression has been reported due to or in connection with UFO sightings. Of course, there were the nuclear bases, U.S. nuclear bases that were neutralized or switched off with the sighting of UFOs. Robert Hastings has done a lot of research in that field. And he brought together statements from 120 military or formerly military personnel, and seven or 12 of them appeared at a press conference in 2010. He produced a documentary about it. And that just shows, and it was also stated, among others, by Robert Salas, a former Air Force captain, I believe, that they could have done much worse. They could have destroyed these nuclear weapons, and they didn't, you know. And there are so many other statements from high-ranking individuals, government officials, who agree, but the U.S. government still chooses to present it as a threat.
See, I would agree with you on the nuclear mitigation kind of situations. It seems more to me that whatever they are, they're almost trying to show us a lesson and to say, look, you don't actually want to fire these things. Look, let's see how you feel when we start turning them on and they're counting down and then we turn them back off again, teach you a lesson, show you that you don't want to do that. But there are people that would disagree with you on the level of threat that this phenomenon poses. I'm more in your camp than others, but there will be people who are saying, well, what about abductions? What about the traumatizing experiences that I've had as a child? You know, where do you sit on this side of the debate? Because there is quite a significant population in the UFO community who claim to have been traumatized and have had horrible experiences.
Yes, indeed. And I in no way want to diminish or deny people their personal experiences. But we need to face the facts, and the facts are that when you know the early contactees came forward and speak about their experiences with the people who emerged from the spacecraft that had landed and who had in many cases been invited on board flying saucer spacecraft. For perhaps a trip around the planet or around the solar system. None of them, since the first recorded accounts, spoke of abductions, having been abducted.
Yeah.
There were no negative experiences until, especially George Adamski was very, very vocal about, but he was not the only one, about the message that these visitors from space brought with them, which was nuclear weapons are dangerous. And you need to find a way to cooperate internationally, to work together to eliminate these weapons, to ensure your survival on this planet. And when you do, you know, we will be able to help you develop new technology. This message of, you know, international, the importance of peace and international cooperation was gaining real traction, especially in the United States, because that was one of the main players during the Cold War, of course, with the Soviet Union. And when the authorities, this is my understanding and interpretation of the events, when the authorities saw that this message was becoming popular, and you know, there's a nice photograph of an audience at a lecture given by George Adamski in 1954, which was a hall in Detroit filled to the rafters with 4,700 people. And people were, you know, they were inspired with hope. Mm. Oh, wait, there's a way out of this nuclear mess, this threat, because it was a huge threat, which even went on into the 1960s and 70s and 80s. So the authorities felt that, you know, of course, for the ongoing expenditure on expanding the nuclear arsenal, they need public funds. They mm-hmm. need, you know, taxes need to be spent. And you need public support in order to do that. So when they felt that the public support might be undermined by these positive messages of peace and inspiring messages of international cooperation, I hold that is when they decided to enlist the entertainment industry.
Right, start running interference, basically.
Yes, and influencing public opinion. Mm. And the first story about abduction only appeared in 1961. Mm. My question is, if there have been, and you know, it's not about everyone from space is friendly and is on our team, because just as we have more or less evolved individuals on this planet, there will be more or less evolved planets in the solar system and beyond. So, you know, they will not all have reached the same level of consciousness that we talked about before. But if the visitors who have made themselves so visible since 1947, actually the end of the Second World War, with the Foo Fighters chasing the jets, both the Allies and the Axis jets. And, you know, and then we had Roswell in 1947, 75 years ago this year. And we had Kenneth Arnold, who first cited and coined the term flying saucers in the same month in 1947. And then we had Adamski and Bethroom and all the other people who said they had personal experience. If that had been going on since 45, 47, 1952, and there were visitors from space, would there not have been visitors from space who are not so friendly, and who, why are there no stories about abduction from 1947 to 1961? It doesn't make sense. So to me, that is a story that has been, or a narrative that has been planted to influence public opinion. Doesn't mean that people haven't had those experiences, because they are very vivid. And Stephen Greer, the guy who's done a lot for disclosure and is a disclosure activist and the CE5 movement, he has documented efforts by shady agencies where people would be abducted, making them believe they were abducted by aliens, you know, through drugs or hypnosis or what have you. So it's meant to scare people, to confuse people, to take away from the notion that the people who do come here, mm-hmm. visitors from space who do come here, are here in support. And it's interesting, because Benjamin Cram has said, and he's not the only one, because there's also other, an American scientist, Michael Wolff, he wrote a book, and also the Canadian contactee, and researcher Wilbert Smith, all three said that based on their own information, the people from other planets who are here since the 1950s have built around our planet what they call a band of light that doesn't allow people from less evolved planets to come here and wreak havoc or to mess with our minds even more than our minds are messed up already. So, you know, that is my take on the abduction narrative. Yes, people are given very nasty experiences, but never by extraterrestrials.
Well, I think this idea of running interference against a narrative that doesn't kind of apply to what the governments want to do is reasonable. We actually have examples of that outside of the UFO community. I mean, just look at the counterculture of the 1960s and the acid revolution and the fact that suddenly all of these teenagers would rather sell watermelon on the side of the road than go off and fight in Vietnam. That scared the hell out of the governments, and there was a concerted effort to completely eradicate any sort of positive messaging around psychedelics. And so I think that when you do have examples where something is trying to push up that's positive and that is against war and is against that kind of military-industrial complex, and then you see this very visceral reaction from the government of disinformation and running interference, then I have to admit that it's certainly reasonable to assume that if there was a similar message being professed through the UFO contact community about love, about peace, about connectivity, about not fighting, then a pro-war military-industrial complex government would seek any avenue it could to eradicate that message and to kind of disrupt that. So I, you know, me personally, I've had experiences with the phenomenon. My experiences actually did come off of the back of CE5, trying to do those types of things, going out into my back garden, getting into a calm state of mind and projecting the intention that I wanted to have contact. And the whole reason that I have this YouTube channel is because I did actually have some successful instances of contact. And all of that for me was completely aligned in peace and love and connectivity and trying to reach out. So yeah, maybe I have a bias because my experiences were certainly not negative. And I, like you, I don't want to dismiss so many people who truly feel that they are traumatized from their experiences. But there is a very, very strong indication, as you were saying, that there are what they call MILAB, military abduction. You know, I've spoken to a few people. I've spoken to people in the intelligence community who have said that that's absolutely something they believe is going on, that there is a concerted effort to create a counter narrative, and that it's human operations, it's black budget operations, and I think that that's possible when you look at the historical evidence of how the government reacts when a message is coming out that they don't want to come out.
Yes, very much so, and I think you rightly make a comparison with the 1960s counterculture movement. It's sad, but you know, it's the powers that be have everything to lose.
Yeah, exactly.
From what's going on now, and
exactly.
What they've been trying to fight and hold back, but you can't hold it back.
No,
unless perhaps through destruction, but then you destroy yourself in the process. So it's amazing. I find it amazing to read that. Exactly, this notion is what George Adamski described in the 1950s. You may have read the introduction to my latest book, where I quote from several letters that he wrote, and he literally says, you know, it's war that keeps the current systems going.
Yeah,
and you know, we can see wars around us to this day. I mean, it isn't it an embarrassment to, you know, being human that there's a war being fought in Europe in 2022?
Yeah,
you know, it's just a disgrace. And I believe there's economic motives behind it more than anything else.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Do you think that the UFO issue is representative of a single phenomenon, or do you think this is a spectrum of phenomena that we're experiencing?
Can you elaborate?
Well, I suppose, like, are we dealing with a single intelligence? Are we dealing with multiple different species? You know?
Yes. See, when you see the manifestation of life in terms of the evolution of consciousness, then it follows almost inevitably that life manifests on every planet. And our planet is one unit in the solar system, as is every other planet, but together they form a larger unit on a cosmic scale. Science, our current probes, do not detect any signs of life, intelligent life, in any case, so on other planets, or even circumstances where they say life as we know it may occur in the rest of the solar system. Even though, you know, gradually there have been, oh, wait, no, there is water on. Oh, wait, there are phosphines on Venus, which are only produced by life, organisms. So slowly, even the conventional scientific method is finding evidence of life scattered around the solar system. But it's important to realize that we've already established that our material reality is not the final word, is not, you know, the foundation of reality, is not the ultimate reality. Our planet happens to be the planet, according to the teachings, where life precipitates down to the grossest level of dense material manifestation. On the other planets in our solar system, apparently based on our observations through our photographic equipment on probes that we send to Mars or have flying around Venus or around the solar system, there's no physical life on other planets. So we conclude, our science concludes, hey, there's no life, there's no civilizations, contrary to what George Adamski said or the other contactees in the 1950s. Mind you, there were many people in Italy and South America as well who know who've had their own contacts. It wasn't just Americans. And according to the teachings, if life manifests through the evolution of consciousness, it doesn't necessarily need a carbon-based physical expression. There's levels of material reality above the three that I mentioned before: physical, dense physical, liquid physical, and gaseous physical. They are called according to the theosophical teaching, etheric planes of matter. David Bohm would probably call them the implicate order, or maybe that's even more fundamental than the etheric planes of matter. Rupert Sheldrake has talked about the morphogenetic fields, where nature retrieves the blueprints for any physical form that that is born or created. Semyon Kurlian invented a photographic technology which could record energy emanating from physical bodies that is invisible to our sight. And there are other, you know, what have been known as fringe science discoveries or developments that all point to that same reality of subtle planes of matter above the more physical planes of matter. And according to the teachings, I would say that every planet has its own humanity, its own human kingdom, but on one of the higher planes of matter, which so far are invisible to our sight, but they, when they come to our planet, for instance, and especially when they're, you know, when they are evolved in consciousness, they can lower the rate of vibration of their composing molecules or whatever it is, atoms, to be visible to our sight. If they incarnate on this planet for a particular mission, they would just take the Earth human form, you know, the form that is common here. But on every planet, the breath of life, the stream of life, manifests in cycles, and on every planet that results at some point in the existence of the human kingdom. So You know, there are people on Venus, there are people on Jupiter, there are people on Pluto, there are people everywhere. And this sounds, I know this sounds crazy to people who read the newspaper, the science section in the newspaper. I think, what is this guy? What did he smoke or whatever? But this is just, you know, it only takes the step in outlook on life that life doesn't depend on a carbon-based physical form. There are subtle physical forms, again, which we don't usually see. Some people have etheric vision. Mm-hmm. And lots of children are known to have, and animals are known to have etheric vision. And they see things that grown-ups think, well, don't know what's wrong with him or her, but, the whole area of fairies and gnomes, etc. Mm-hmm. Those are lower life forms in the etheric on our planet. On Venus, on Mars, on all those planets, there are oceans, there are forests, there are lakes and houses and buildings, all on the etheric planes of matter, from which on our planet, you know, everything mm-hmm. has precipitated into this dense physical stuff. That you can touch.
Well, this is. Sorry, go on. No, please.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, this is where we were talking about the fact that right now horizons need to be expanded within science, and that there are perhaps dimensional folds that you just can't perceive right now because we don't have perhaps the sophisticated level of technology, perhaps the sophisticated level of mind. And I wonder if perhaps through technological advancements, we might be able to, as I was saying before, unlock more spiritual, more ethical, or even just esoteric answers to life, and perhaps we will be able to develop the tools to observe these other dimensional layers that seem to be kind of comprised of reality. Because as you said, we are just in this kind of dense matter state, and so all we see around us is this dense matter state. And if that's not the final state of reality, and there are all these other states that are right next door to it that we just can't perceive, then of course we're gonna be completely ignorant to the level of life that's out there right in front of us.
Yes. I think partly, you know, the examples that I mentioned, the Killian photography, morphogenetic fields, and Wilhelm Reich with his organ accumulator, radiation that he discovered. There are some discoveries have been made, experiments have been done. But I don't think technology will help us make that shift. Fortunately, as we mentioned, the science is making steps in the right direction and acknowledging that there is a very subjective element to existence, to reality, that cannot be reduced to pinned down on a material aspect of reality. And this is where, you know, the post-materialist branch of science that is really coming up now and emerging and growing. Edgar Mitchell, the former Apollo 14 astronaut, has founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS. Is doing research in that field. You have the scientific and medical network in the UK, the Campaign for Open Science. There's a whole movement going on in the scientific arena that recognizes that the empirical reductionist view of reality in the world cannot stand. It doesn't explain for everything. And I think for me, the teachings of the Ages of Wisdom brings together, and that's what I try to show in my book, brings together science and spirituality. You know, the spiritual aspect and the more material, physical view of reality. I personally don't know, but I don't think that it will be a technological development that will allow us to see or connect with the other dimensions. it will be this shift in our outlook and its expression, because as I said, many people have already made that shift. And now they seem to have sort of stepped back from taking it to its logical consequence and acting on it, in the face of unbudging structures, outdated structures. But I think only when a critical mass of humanity has realized in first place that they've made that shift in awareness and then act on it and actively move towards manifesting that in, that notion of oneness. We are one human race and we are one with the planet, and manifesting that in their lives, then, we will see a gradual evolution in our sensory abilities as well. The interesting thing, which I mentioned also in my book, is that a few years ago, there was some social research was done, which concluded that it only requires something like 3.5% of population to move towards a positive change, which has a lasting to have a lasting effect. So that is another reason for massive hope, because we don't need everyone on board this notion of we're one, because it's not realistic. It's not even realistic. Not everyone is in that space yet.
But everyone has the components can click into place with a relatively low level of the population.
And even a relatively low percentage would be a critical mass. And that's fascinating.
How do you feel about transhumanism, this idea that humanity will converge with technology in a way that could almost be seen as the birth of a new species? Because we're certainly moving closer towards integrating technology into our physical bodies, and with the dawning of things like Elon Musk's Neuralink, where they're inserting artificially intelligent circuits into the human brain, and with virtual reality and quantum computation, it certainly certainly seems that at least some aspect of the human population is going to kind of submerge themselves into this new digital domain. This is something I've been kind of struggling with myself, and I'm trying to wrap my head around it. Is this just an evolutionary component of humanity's step forward, and it's just a transition process? Or have we made a really big mistake? Are we making critical errors in our collective decision making by integrating further with technology? What do you think about transhumanism?
I think it's based on a misunderstanding of the nature of or what it means to be human, or of the reality of life. To me, it clearly misses the point that the human race is, the human kingdom is a phase in the evolution, in the manifestation of life. And it doesn't require technology to evolve further. It will develop technology, to live this physical life, to move around the planet and maybe between planets. But I think it's a misconception, really, to think that linking or building in technology in human bodies will make a faster or higher evolution possible, because this technology is only a reflection of our consciousness. Unless we need to realize that, I mentioned before, we have a physical body, emotional body, and a mental body. When these three have come to a point of coordination in the course of many incarnations that we go through, you get the emergence of what we know, the personality. You get a coordinated personality on the physical plane in incarnation, someone who with some level of informed decision, acts in the world and makes a difference at a certain level. And when that personality has reached a point of coordination, that's when the soul, our spiritual aspect, can get a hold of it, can connect with it, and through meditation and service, making ourselves useful to the world around us, contributing in a positive way, we then grow in our expression of our spiritual source, our, you know, the highest form of consciousness that informs us. And it's that connection and that expanding expression of our spirituality, our spiritual nature, that drives on and fastens speeds up our evolution. There's nothing to do with technology.
Mm.
You know, we may have a meditation technique that may be helpful or maybe not so helpful, effective or not. Once we realize, and there's millions of people today in the world who do so realize, that we are a spiritual entity in physical incarnation, not the other way around. And you know, it's that is also the reason why the masters of wisdom, those superhumans, so to speak, are able to come back into the world as a group, because there's so many people ready to make that step and who have begun to reconnect with their spiritual source, just because they've evolved, they've traveled the path of evolution back to the source far enough for their soul, so to speak, to use that terminology, to get a grip of the vehicle, the physical plane vehicle, and stimulate its further growth. So yeah, I don't implanting, you know, technology and all those things, it's nothing to do with that.
I find myself in agreement with that. Do you have plans to write more books on these topics?
Yes, but my first book, my next project will be another one about George Adamski, because as I was preparing my previous book, Letters to Emma Martinelli, about his correspondence in the 1950s, mm-hmm. before he became famous for his contacts, when I was preparing that book, I noticed several points which disclosure activists are chasing, are hoping the government to open up about, which George Adamski actually talked about. One very striking example, I think, and it's in that book with correspondence. He took a photograph of a saucer-shaped craft against the moon, very bright saucer-shaped craft, in 1950. When you invert that photograph and you place it next to one of the stills from the videos that the Pentagon has officially released recently, you see exactly the same craft.
Mm.
You can even discern, you know, a slight force field in Adamski's photograph, which is a lot lower resolution and no digital enhancement and all those things, no infrared. So that's just a simple example of things that have been known for so long and are only now gradually being confirmed by official dog. So there are several points that I want to emphasize, also because this year is 70 years since his first contact in the desert,
mm-hmm.
with an individual from Venus. So to commemorate that, I thought I put that together in a book, but after that, no doubt there will be more books along the lines of UFOs and the Pioneers of Oneness.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to the next installment, because I really enjoyed this book. And Jared, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you on these subjects. It's always a treat to engage with someone intellectually on these issues who entertains expansive understandings of what could be possible and inspires people to think outside of the box, because these are conversations that require us to think outside of the pre-existing parameters that we've put around reality. And I think that conversations like this can act as a catalyst for others to ask harder questions and to think upon larger concepts. So I just want to thank you so much for your contribution to that effort, and it's been a real pleasure to talk about this with you.
Thank you so much. And indeed, you know, it's time to think outside the box and not a moment too soon. And, you know, I'll let you know about my upcoming books and perhaps we can talk again.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd also like to encourage everyone to check out Jared's written work, including Pioneers of Oneness, links to which can be found in the description box below. And if you want to support Project Unity and gain access to a fast-growing social hub of researchers and curious minds, then please consider signing up to the Project Unity Patreon membership, and you will gain access to our private Discord server. Links for this can be found in the description box below. Jared, thank you once again for joining me. It was a really great conversation.
It was a pleasure, Jake.